This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, police officers and firefighters say they should have a choice about where they live, no matter where they work. And Mayor Ray Nagin orders minority contractors be used for rebuilding New Orleans. Joining us today from our New York bureau is E.R. Shipp, professor of journalism, Hofstra University School of Communication. In Nashville, Tennessee, we've got Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle at Spotland Productions, and Glenn Lowry, professor of social sciences at Brown University, is at member station WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome, folks, and let's go to the police and firefighters. You've got lawsuits and protests in Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, Louisiana. Police especially are really against rules that require them and other municipal employees to reside in the communities that they serve. Some of them say, you know, we're either priced out of the market or we have to live in neighborhoods where we're investigating people. What's the issue here, Glenn? Is it community policing should be done really with community police, or is it dangerous to the officers themselves and their families to be forced to live in neighborhoods where they are working?
Well, why is this even an issue?
Lowry.
Jinx. Go ahead.
Shall I go?
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, I think that people are concerned that you have public servants who are on the public payroll, but who may not be, in some sense, identifying with and have a stake in the municipality that they're serving. And so these kind of laws come up as a way of trying to ensure that the people who are collecting their salaries from the city are also identifying with the city. But I must say, I don't think it's often a good idea to do it this way. There are other ways that you can train and enforce a kind of sympathetic rendering of service to the residents of a city without forcing the employees to live there. If you forced everyone who is providing any kind of service to a city to be a resident of a city, it's effectively taxing the wages of people because it limits their options, and you may have a hard time finding qualified people to do the jobs that you want to fill. So I think there are better ways of responding to the public's demand for sympathetic public servants who identify with the circumstances of people who are living in the cities.
Like what, though?
Well, train them and evaluate them in their performance on the job based in part on the extent to which they actually render high-quality service. I mean, if I were running a private company, a department store, I would want people working in the department store to treat my customers very well, but I don't necessarily get that by requiring that people who work for my department store live within a five-mile radius of where the store is located. I train the employees. Pardon?
That's a whole different other issue. Partly involved in this is the fact that these are people who are being employed by a governmental body to serve the citizens of the particular area. And one can justify that governmental body requiring its people to be part of that community. Some of the arguments that are being raised by these police and firefighters include the fact that they don't want to be living among poor people in poor schools. That sort of mentality automatically tells you that we're in trouble because they don't know the people, they don't know the communities, and they may overreact, particularly in the police department. They may overreact when it comes to addressing what they perceive to be criminal activity, and it may not actually be that. We've had many instances of that in recent years. So I understand cities and counties saying, if you're going to be paid by us to be public servants, particularly in the areas of public safety, you need to be part of this community.
Jeff, what do you think?
Well, on the one hand, the stakes are higher, indeed, when a person resides in the area that they serve in. When you come into the community to work and you can leave it and go home at the end of the day, you just don't have the same investment. The other issue that I think highlights this, there was a big pastor in Nashville once that used to really be well known for endorsing local political candidates until it was found out that he lived outside of the county. And so he was having people inside the county put their votes and trust in people that would be making decisions that affected their lives when the same taxes and all of that didn't affect him. I think residency laws are designed to raise the stakes of particularly service employees. However, the flip side is that not only can you have a situation where the starting income for a police officer is under $50,000 a year in a market where average homes are just over $400,000, like in Washington, D.C., but you deal with other issues like the safety of officers who might run into somebody they are investigating or may have arrested. A policeman acquaintance of mine actually dealt with that because he had a twin brother, and they both lived in the area. The twin would get these antagonistic looks from people from time to time. It took him a while to figure out what it was. I think one of the compromises can be to expand the radius of residency in some extreme cases, and then you have to allow each city to deal with this as it affects them specifically. But by and large, though, I still see the value of residency laws and making sure there isn't a breeding of an us
and them mentality.
And
maybe one of the perks that can be offered would be to make the municipal employees, in this case we're talking police and firefighters, to make them eligible for some of the affordable housing that a number of municipalities are talking about providing. I'm thinking of New York, for example. Let them have extra chips to get on the list for this affordable housing. Now, going back in the way back when, it was police officers and fire people lived in the neighborhood. People knew who they were. They helped to add stability to the communities. It wasn't an us against them kind of thing, which I think we've developed in the last few decades.
Well, Glenn, on that point that ER made, isn't this a lot, or doesn't it say a lot both about the intersection of race and class, and also about how neighborhoods, even within races, if you talk about, you know, cities that might have, for example, a majority black population and a majority black police force, but there is this socioeconomic stratification even within the race.
Yeah, there is. I mean, in cities that are in decline and neighborhoods that are in decline, I was thinking about public school teachers. I mean, in a city like Chicago, which I know very well, how many public school teachers in the city will have moved, African-American public school teachers, out of a neighborhood that's in decline on the south or the west side of the city to one of the near-end suburbs where they can commute into their jobs? They will have done it because they're concerned about their families. You can hardly blame them about that. Requiring them to stay in a neighborhood that's in decline is to impose a very heavy burden upon them, which we wouldn't impose upon other residents of the city who happen not to be collecting their paychecks from the public payroll. So while I understand it, I mean, the impulse to say you should live in the community that you serve is right. I don't object to that. But as a practical matter, to impose that burden just upon those people, when in many circumstances, most of us might move across a municipal jurisdiction line to get better schools or lower price housing for our families, to impose that on the relatively few people who happen to be working for the city is just going to make it hard to recruit people into those jobs in the future.
I want to transition to another topic. New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin signed an order this week requiring that large businesses use as many local and minority-owned firms as possible when going after millions in tax incentives and grants. So his executive order requires applicants to involve 50% local businesses and 35% women or minority-controlled businesses, but then the clause is whenever possible.
That's the key.
A clause like whenever possible, ER, what does that really mean?
That's what it means. It's like, remember Brown versus Board of Education? With all due speed or deliberate speed or whatever,
it took
like 40 years to put that into effect. I understand what he's trying to do, and it's a good goal, but it's totally unenforceable, and it depends upon the goodwill of those people who want to do business with New Orleans. But there's no way he can impose these goals on anybody legally, morally, ethically, or whatever.
Jeff, if you didn't have whenever possible, if you did have this 50%, 35% rule, don't you think at this point in time that courts would step in and it would all get bogged down in legislation? So it seems as if, you know, this sort of soft rule that Mayor Nagin has made an order, do you see that as better than nothing?
I think it's better than nothing. I don't know if the courts would step in as much as people would step in and bring in the courts, but I'll have to echo an age-old adage here, and that is that freedom isn't free. Anyone who lives in the supposed land of the free and home of the brave knows that. Just as ad infinitum property taxes make it so that no matter how fast you pay land and structures off, you never truly own them free and clear, racism and discrimination make it difficult, to say the least, for there to be a truly equal playing field. And until the time that we have no more things like redlining, insider trading, or as we call it down south, the good old boy network, those exist everywhere, mind you, under other monikers, we still have a need for some way to attempt to bring fairness and equity into a process. And in this case, Mayor Nagin is attempting enfranchisement for people who have traditionally been left out of the process of redevelopment, be that at home in this case or abroad as in Iraq.
Glenn, you know, Mayor Nagin became famous or infamous for his Chocolate City comment. And yet, when you go to New Orleans, as I have been several times since Katrina, you do see an influx of Latin American and Central American workers. You see a lot of young brothers hustling to try to find, you know, off the records, part-time work because they don't feel like they're getting their due in the legitimate workforce. So what else could be done besides just a work order like this?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the foreign-born workers who've been imported into New Orleans to help to clean up, working for these companies that are picking up the trash and such. There was sort of basically two thoughts that I had. One is that 50% local and 35% women and minority are very large numbers, even if those are targets or goals. Didn't have to be 50 and 35%. I don't think those numbers are practical. But I wouldn't object in principle to the idea of trying to mandate some local and minority inclusion, because a lot of money is being spent and all kinds of politics are going to be played as to who's going to get access to that money. So a little bit of racial politics along the side is not a big deal. But the main point that I would want to make is, what about the thousands and tens of thousands of New Orleans residents who have been displaced and who still don't have jobs or a livelihood? If the city is going to be rebuilt, I'm not only concerned about minority-owned firms, I'm also concerned about former city residents and the possibility of them having access to some of these jobs. So, you know, I mean, he's taking care of a certain political constituency. That's his job. I think 35% is probably too high, but something along those lines is justifiable. But it doesn't really get to the core problem for most of the residents or former residents of New Orleans.
I just want to move on to one last topic. We have got to revisit Foley, Congressman Mark Foley, and his emails to a former teenage page. Being a page is this very, you know, prestigious job for teenagers on Capitol Hill. And now House Speaker Dennis Hastert is facing calls for his resignation. But Hastert says the GOP has done the right thing thus far.
No one in the Republican leadership, nor Congressman Shimkus, saw those messages until last Friday when ABC News released them to the public. When they were released, Congressman Foley resigned, and I'm glad he did. If he had not, I would have demanded his expulsion from the House of Representatives. The PAGE program is an important part of this institution. It has inspired many generations to enter public service. It is a trust, and as a parent and the Speaker of the House, I am disgusted that Congressman Foley broke that trust.
Now, I've read some of these emails, you know, or IM exchanges, and they're pretty raw. You know, it's you can't even, like, pretend that there's something else going on there when you're asking about inches of manhood and things like that. Mm-hmm. But now there's some reports saying that people as long as 5 years ago on Capitol Hill said, stay away from Foley, you know, started telling the pages that. Who should really bear the brunt of responsibility for what's gone on here? Should Hastert bear any responsibility, ER?
Well, yes, because we have this tradition of the buck stops here. And so he is the Speaker of the House, and the buck should stop with him. Of course, the person who's primarily responsible for everything is Mr. Foley himself. And he's, of course, now trying to pass the buck to everybody, from a clergyman who may have abused him, to alcohol, to being gay. All of that sounds like excuses. But when one looks at who knew what when, it seems that the leadership in the House had ample warning that something was going on. As far back as a year ago, there was commentary about the emails and the instant messaging that was totally inappropriate. Now, the speaker is saying the information never got to him. Well, somebody then didn't do their job. And again, the buck would stop with him.
Glenn?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, the hypocrisy here is almost unbelievable. Remember, this is the same Republican Congress that tried to impeach the President of the United States for what he did, which I'm not endorsing. This is the same Republican Congress that gets elected on the moral values theme all across this country. I read those emails, and they will make your hair stand on end. And the idea that teenage Americans have to be protected from members of the House of Representatives, you've got Republicans talking about maybe we should abolish the PAGE program. We tut-tut-tut about how superior our culture and our civilization is. That's the argument. The Muslims are backward, they're et cetera, we're enlightened and so forth. And yet in our government, our own children are not safe from the politicians' sexual predation.
Jeff, we've got about a minute left.
Yeah, and I'll be frank. I read that I Am thread, and it was stomach-turning. And I didn't want to continue reading all of it because I didn't want to have a bad dream about it last night.
Right.
We add to the fact that this was a kid, it makes it all that more appalling. It's appalling that it took place. It's appalling that it wasn't dealt with. It's appalling that even though this wasn't the particular thread that happened earlier, there was an earlier email that Hastert was made aware of. On one hand, I would say it'd be unfair to put the behavior of one legislator on another. However, if there was any lack of investigation on the leadership's part, it casts a dark shadow on the entire affair, so to speak. So by keeping this as an internal matter, the GOP make themselves look really bad. And as Glenn said, it's a sad shame when you're on one hand being supposedly pro-life, but then you can mentally destroy and kill children through inappropriate sexual behavior and contact in a government environment.
And we're seeing the cynicism of now trying to turn this into the Democrats are trying to sabotage the elections.
All right. Well,
some
folks,
of the chief critics are Republicans.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you for weighing in. E.R. Shipp, professor in journalism, Hofstra University School of Communication. Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle at Spotland Productions in Nashville, Tennessee. And Glenn Lowry, professor of the social sciences and professor of economics at Brown University. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks, Farai.